And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is GCaptain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of GCaptain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles and in the studio with me is John Conrad. Welcome, John. How are you today?
Great morning today, Jeff.
All right. Good to see you today in the studio. This broadcast is for the week of September 30th, 2013. Listeners, this is the place we bring you the latest news and happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. Several interesting things to speak with you about today. We have some Greenpeace activists that were, well, they were picked up and they may be shipped off themselves. So we're going to talk about what happened there. We also will touch on a lifeboat drop, but this isn't any ordinary lifeboat drop. This lifeboat was dropped from quite a distance up, and that actually may have set a record or two. So we'll see what's going on with that. It reminds me of my old lifeboat drills with my extensive 2 years experience in the Merchant Marine. And if we have a chance to touch on it, we've got some rather large ships, again, that are drawing some attention in the world over in the European hemisphere. So, John, let's get right into it. Several good things to speak about. We've got these Greenpeace folks, sometimes referred to as, well, I think they would call themselves eco-activists, but they are sometimes referred to in a more derogatory term, eco-terrorists, and they got themselves into some trouble. So what's going on there?
There's a Russian oil platform in the Arctic off the coast, or the closest port is Murmansk, and they are drilling for oil there. It's been a long-established field. I'm not going to try to pronounce what the field is called. But they first discovered oil in 1989, and they did some development in the early 90s. And with the price of oil being where it is and the expansion, the Russians have decided to reopen the field and put a new, newly built oil rig there. And the Greenpeace isn't very happy about it.
Mm-hmm. So this rig that's out there is a platform type rig?
Correct.
Okay. And so these Greenpeace folks, I suppose the activists decided that they would pay a visit out there. I wonder if they were there to, I guess they weren't there to welcome them to the Arctic, to bring them some fresh baked cookies or something along that line. What do you think they were there for?
Well, Greenpeace says it was there to bring a journalist out. They have a icebreaking ship that they brought out there, and their intent was to bring journalists out to the oil rig. Now, the Gazprom, the company that owns the oil rig, and the Russian authorities denied any access from journalists. Now, this is something that a lot of oil companies do. We, as GCaptain, we're allowed. Rob's been out to many oil rigs, and if we ask an oil company, it's about a 50-50 shot whether they let us. And even if they let us, we have to have the Hewitt and the training classes, and it's a long process to go on the oil rigs. But even here in the Gulf of Mexico, half of the companies just flat out deny.
And of course, all that has to be set up beforehand.
Correct.
You go through the company, you seek approval, you go through whatever screening you need to go through. They verify who you are, and so you can't just show up.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
But apparently these journalists, we have no way to prove it, but the journalists did do that. They did the official request to come on board this oil platform, and it was flatly denied. So then they went to Greenpeace, and Greenpeace says, well, we'll bring you out there, and they did. And then they also brought mountain climbing equipment to actually try to scale the size of this impressive oil rig. And what's really new and interesting about this specific case is what happened next. So normally, someone's trying to scale the rig, whether they're Greenpeace or anyone, you have to assume there's a security issue and try to get them off and call the local Coast Guard and authorities. And the oil rig apparently did that. They sprayed cold water down on these people trying to scale, and these people were kind of did like a mountain climbing tent on the side of the ship. So they put this kind of tent over them while they're dangling there, and water's being sprayed on. And then the oil company called the Russian authorities, who proceeded to do a reverse. They descended down their own rope, boarded the Greenpeace vessel, and then put the vessel, all its crew, and the journalists, arrested them. towed the vessel back to port. Now, what's interesting
and
about...
this was the Russian Coast Guard that did this?
This was the Russian authorities.
The Russian authorities.
We're not sure who exactly, whether it was Coast Guard or the Navy, but official Russian government employees came and commandeered and put this vessel under arrest. And then this ship is flagged to the Netherlands. It's a Netherlands flagship. So they immediately call the Dutch ambassador in Moscow.
So the Greenpeace ship you're referring to is a Netherlands flagship.
Correct.
Gotcha.
They brought the ambassador and pushed charges through the... So this was an all frontal. They actually arrested the ship, but they also are trying to push the political ends and bring the Dutch ambassador and really put pressure from all sides of the government on keeping this oil rig secret and what's going on there out of the eyes of the public. Now, we have two views as a mariner, and having worked on oil rigs, it's a very dangerous operation. That's, you know, there's a lot that can go on in an oil rig. Any activities from someone like Greenpeace is going to distract the workers. Mm-hmm. That's my primary concern, is it's dangerous enough without having to deal with people trying to rappel on. And the crew on board the oil rigs, they don't have any ability to approve or deny these official requests. They're just trying to do their job.
Yeah, they're on the rig doing their job. They're working.
And that's where the Greenpeace and some others kind of get this eco-terrorism. You know, a lot of the crews will use that term because they're just trying to do a job.
Yeah, they're on there providing for themselves and their family.
Correct. Yep. But on the other end is if the oil rig is doing things properly, and the best companies, like we've talked about, Maersk invited me onto the Tripoli, and that Tripoli vessel had a death during construction, so it was dangerous and there were sad things there, but Maersk still said, come on board and we'll discuss all this. This oil company is saying no. So a lot of the companies that do not do things up to the record don't do them the best way or the most protective and secretive. And, you know, I think the big question here is, should journalists be allowed? I think it's pretty obvious that when the official channels are denied, the answer isn't to go scale oil rigs and cause problems for the crew.
Right. And that's what I wanted to point out as well. You mentioned in your introduction that it's not an uncommon practice. As a matter of fact, it sounds like it's almost more common, a more common practice on some of these oil rigs, particularly in the exploration phase, that they deny the requests from journalists to go on. So it seems to me they weren't necessarily singling out Greenpeace here in terms of their denial to give a pass to the journalists.
Correct, but you have to think if this was a Maersk rig, and Maersk has their own oil rig, and they're specialized in adverse environments. So they probably contracted for this field or other ones in Russia. If this had been a Maersk oil rig, we probably would have been invited. This oil rig, we weren't. Now, you can invite journalists before the actual startup just to get a look at the rig. Journalists aren't experts. They're not technical experts. They're not going to be able to give away information that your competitors can use and point out real problems. But it's just there to, unless they're GCAM journalists,
that's
of course,
right.
Then we
that's
can.
That's right. That's what I was thinking, too.
But the question is, you know, this is the Arctic. There's a lot of concern here. There are a lot of public emotions. Shouldn't we try as an industry at some extent to allay some of these concerns, to put them to rest before we go drilling? Because if we just put up a big wall, now you got Greenpeace just issued a picture of this journalist behind bars, and it's getting millions of Facebook likes. It's being broadcast on CNN and everything else. So there's immense public support for this eco-terrorist action because this oil company did not take the basic steps of inviting some journalists on board. They could have even done so prior to leaving port.
Okay, so I think I understand better now where you're going with this. So you're not necessarily defending Greenpeace's actions here, but it seems that you would prefer more transparency on the part of maritime companies, and you used Maersk as an example of one that is more transparent, and that transparency would avoid what may very well turn into a bit of a media circus here that in the long run would wind up probably putting a black eye on the oil company anyway.
Correct. It's just not a black and white issue. And what's really troublesome is the fact that the ship got arrested. Also, because there are maritime laws and you can't it's just unprecedented for a government to actually take over the arrest the crew with military forces and tow them into port. So that a lot of the listeners will maybe agree with that action, but we still have to defend the rights of mariners not to get arrested, because if they arrest Greenpeace, it's a slippery slope that we could go down. That could potentially put mariners or erode the rights of mariners to work unharassed by foreign governments.
I understand, but of course, an important point of this story is that there were, I think it was two people scaling the side of that platform, which in my purview at that point, they're not eco anything. They're not journalists. At that point, they're trespassers. They're potential pirates. So at that point, where do we draw that line?
And I do think the crew was fully aware of what they were going out to do when they left port, when the Arctic Sunrise, when they signed up for Greenpeace, that they may be arrested. So it's not like they're completely innocent, but it's not a black and white issue. And it's something that there's also the side of if the oil company or the crew on the oil rig had heard of it, that water went down or the Greenpeace slipped and sued. And, you know, they're as a mariner on board the ship, you're worried for the safety of these people who are trying to harass you as well. A, because if they're injured, you can have your license taken away. Right. You can get into legal trouble. But also, just as a person, you don't want to see anyone injured on your ship.
Sure. And that's what I was thinking about too, John, is the captain of that ship. It's a Netherlands flagged ship. So there was a captain on board that ship. And at some point, he knew that part of his passengers on board his or her vessel were disembarking, and it was obvious that they were going to that platform because they had to be within eyeshot of the platform. They had to be very near that platform. So I think the captain has some culpability here. What do you think?
Absolutely. I'm sure that Greenpeace made these journalists sign a thing that they will listen to the captain and they'll follow the captain's orders. So the captain is ultimately responsible for the actions of his crew.
Right. And the point that I'm getting at is when there is an inflatable or a pontoon boat that's getting ready to go out to that's getting ready.
The captain knows what they're going out to do.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So, and the other thing that's interesting on this too is that they hooked a line up to the boat and started towing her in, as opposed to taking her in under her own power. And just sort of a curious observation. Would you have any thoughts on why they did that as opposed to took her in under her own power?
Well, you need engineers who know that specific equipment, the manuals and everything else. And obviously, if the engineers are under arrest, we don't know if they handcuffed them or what, but you can't operate that power plant with the engineers all sitting in handcuffs or under arrest.
I guess that does make sense. A little bit more than giving a tug on the old Evan Rude and sparking her up. Well, a very interesting story, and we'll of course keep an eye on this and see where it goes. Now, they're all under arrest at this point. I think it's a large number of, was it everybody on that vessel?
I believe it was 30 crew members plus the journalists. I'd have to double check that number, but a significant number of people. And like I said, there's also the Dutch ambassadors involved, and it's a large geopolitical mess right now.
Yeah, well, this will be a big thing. We will keep a close eye on it here on the show, as well as I'm sure G Captain will keep all our viewers of G Captain and listeners of the show posted on the whole thing. Anything else with regard to that topic, John?
It'll be interesting to see what the Dutch response is. As a mariner, you want your flag to defend you, and Greenpeace and the crew of the Greenpeace are hoping for the Dutch government to defend them in this case. But why did the Dutch government flag the ship, knowing full well Greenpeace's history of these type of attacks on commercial platforms? So that's a real interesting dichotomy. And I believe the Dutch flagged, I don't know if they currently do, but at least at one point, the Sea Shepherd, which is doing a lot more dangerous things, actually ramming ships, causing physical... destroying physical property and putting people at extreme risk. So what is the Dutch government's reaction to this going to be? And are they going to continue to support the extremists like Sea Shepherd, who I really believe are extremists? Or Greenpeace, which is they do things a lot safer than Sea Shepherd, but they still take actions which are questionable.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to keep an eye on any statements from the captain and specifically what happens to that captain, if there's any prosecution with regard to the captain, because in my eyes, it all comes back to the old man. He or she was in command of that ship, and that's where it starts and that's where it ends.
It always does.
That's right. All right. Very interesting story. So we'll keep tabs on that. And listeners, be sure to continue to check G Captain with regard to updates to that story. So this lifeboat drop, this reminds me of, again, our regular listeners know that I've an experienced ordinary seaman of 2 years back in my early 20s. It was about 25 years ago, and sailed the Atlantic Ocean and a little bit out in the Pacific, blue water in both. And out there, we've talked about sometimes the routine and even a little bit of boredom out at sea. I used to really look forward to the lifeboat drills because we'd go out and we'd do our lifeboat drill and drop the davits out and drop the boat down, 10 or 15 feet. And of course, we wouldn't set it in the water, but drop her 15 feet and pull it back up and secure the davits again. And it gave us something to do for an hour or so.
Something to do other than chipping paint.
That's right, scraping and chipping. To be honest with you, I haven't read this story on G Captain, so I'll take a look at it as we're talking about. But this is the highest, the longest, the tallest lifeboat drop in history here. What's going on with the lifeboat drop, John?
So I assume on your ship there were traditional davits where the boat would be connected to the davits until it reached the water. Then you disconnect the davits and go off on your way. But these are the free fall lifeboats. So they're on this sleigh that points down to the water. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar. And you pull one and you disconnect from the davit and the ship completely right away. And the boat goes and it falls down and it actually submerges under the water and pops up. Fully enclosed lifeboat. Wow. That does this.
Well, those are the expensive, nice lifeboats, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And they literally just slide off at the side of the mothership and just dive right into the water.
They call it a sleigh ride because it's feels like you're in a sleigh. But when you get to a certain height, the water becomes less like water and more like a concrete surface.
Yeah.
And that's the issue with this height. Every extra foot of height when you get to a certain level requires that the hull of the lifeboat is strengthened significantly to protect it from the impact damage.
Right.
Now, these aren't necessarily for ships. They're not building ships. The record that they just beat is 220 feet.
Wow.
So they dropped this lifeboat from 220 feet right into the water. And this is not for a ship. These are really, these heights are for these ultra new, extremely large oil platforms, floaters really, that are floating in the water but have an immense height when they're not ballasted down. So a lot of these semi-submersibles, when they're under transit, they pump out the ballast and they float up and they become very high off the water line.
Mm-hmm.
So your height is limited to one of the factors that limits the amount that they can deballast, they can raise these platforms up, is the lifeboats. They mm-hmm. cannot go above a certain height above water if their lifeboats are not capable of that height. So the lifeboat manufacturers have been being pushed by the oil companies who are building these mega platforms to create lifeboats that are capable of being dropped from greater heights. But as we said, even a couple feet, once you reach 200 feet, is that impact is more significant. So they have to use advanced materials. And if you look at the design, there are pictures on the post of G Captain, which we'll link to from the show notes. But this thing really looks like a James Bond type submarine.
It does.
It's pretty impressive design. Now, there are other issues that you have to factor into the engineering. Obviously, a lifeboat has to have a propeller in order to move. So that propeller is right on the bottom. That's being impacted. So that has to be strong and impactful. The crew needs a way to get in. So there have to be doors and there has to be a window for the helmsman to actually pilot the ship.
And I don't think this is a dumb question. The crew obviously has to be very secure in there because they're in there when the boat's dropped, correct?
Correct. You have five-point harnesses, so like a race car has. And actually on the higher drop lifeboats, you actually, some of them you wear a helmet and others, but most of them you strap in your head as well, because the whiplash of your neck could actually break your spine. Mm-hmm. So you'll strap in your head and mm-hmm. they'll make sure everyone is fully strapped in before they launch this boat. And the forces on, you know, when you hit that water are immense. It's like a G-force that
sure
pulls you.
So the seats must actually look kind of like race car seats or some type of seat that you are fully strapped into.
Correct.
Wow. Very
design.
I'd love to see one. You know, if we can get that on G-Captain sometime, I'd love to see pictures of the interior of one of these boats. That would be really cool to see. I'm looking at G-Captain right now, and there are some fantastic pictures on here. So listeners, you have to be sure and check it out, as well as an actual video of I believe that's a video of the drop. I haven't watched the video yet, but as soon as we're done recording this, John, I'm going to watch that video.
Or if you want to see the interior of one of these boats, go watch the Captain Phillips movie where he's on the lifeboat. That's coming out in theaters pretty soon. I haven't checked the release date, but that story of the Maersk Alabama, the pirate attack, the captain left the ship with the pirates, and much of that you'll see Tom Hanks inside one of these lifeboats for a significant portion of the movie.
Oh, no kidding. Excellent. Well, very good. So this also speaks then to the continual evolution and innovation of these lifeboats. So they're just getting better and better as technology and time progresses. Is that fair to say?
For the most part. But there's an evil side of technology.
Ooh, man, this sounds like some good radio right here, John. Talk to me about the evil side of the evolution of lifeboat technology.
Just talking to a friend who's considering buying a new sailboat. And I have a sailboat, but it's older design, and I like that design. Because when my boat was built, 1980s, first it's all the interior is teak, and it's beautiful. But also, the computers they didn't have precise engineering mechanisms. So they had to overbuild everything because they couldn't. Now, if you look at the manual of a sailboat going back decades, there's always a legal disclaimer, do not take this boat out in over, say, 60 knots of wind. You know, it could be different for the manufacturer.
Right.
But in 1980, when they built my boat, they had to overbuild
exactly,
it
yeah.
just to meet that 60.
Right.
Now, with the computers and the technology, you know, they can make the fiberglass thinner. They
right.
can use less material to make the boat faster.
Very interesting.
And make sure that you meet that exactly. So they'll still put in a fudge factor, but how much is that fudge factor? It'll only be like 10%. So you get in winds over 70 knots, and you're...
Over how many knots? 70, did you say?
70 knots.
Over 70 knots in a sailboat. Okay.
Now,
if you're out in winds over 70 knots in a sailboat...
it's extreme.
Yes.
But when you're out in the ocean, say you're going to Hawaii.
Right.
How do you... You're a hurricane, you can't get out of the way. How do you prevent... The manufacturer says, do not take this out over 60 knots. Well, if you're in the middle of the ocean...
The common sense says, don't take it out. But yeah, I can see if you're stuck out there.
And I'm not saying that this is an extreme case, but this goes down to other engineering factors. This lifeboat is engineered, and NorSafe, I really like NorSafe. They do a good design, and they over-engineer everything.
Which is the Norwegian firm that built this.
Correct. They make some really good boats. But say this boat... It's tested to 200. You put it on a platform for 200. That's 200 feet above the water. Now you have 30-foot seas.
Mm.
If this is accidentally launched in a trough, you know, now you have 215 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And if it engineered just to the precision of that 200, the lifeboat will break apart with that extra
right.
15 feet
right.
potentially. So you can't... The computer-aided design is allowing us to push these boundaries, but it's making the fudge factor less prominent.
Yeah.
And that, when you exceed that, the manufacturer's limits, and sometimes you're forced to, based on the weather or operating conditions or just emergency, when you exceed those, you're in a lot more peril than if you exceeded the manufacturer's recommendation on something that was built 30 years ago.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It makes a lot of sense. So those sort of maximum, the maximum specs, specifications for the equipment and the gear back then had more of, as you call it, a fudge factor. And that does make sense because they couldn't analyze things as precisely as they do today. Well, the takeaway from that for me is these days in this modern technology world is to pay a little bit more close attention to those maximum specs on our gear, on our equipment, and on our vessels.
Yeah, and I wouldn't go out in a small sailboat at 50 knots, let alone 60 or 70. I'm not trying to propound that.
Well, that's the thing. I've been on your boat a couple. I've been on your boat a couple times, John. We haven't been sailing yet together out there. And now, after you mentioning taking the sailboat out in 70-knot winds, I'm not sure we are going to go sailing out there, but
we do live near Point Conception, and I've hit 50-knot winds, gusts up to 50, 45, 40-knot sustained gusts up to 50. Oof. On that, and it held up nicely, but yeah, Point Conception is right here. So if you want that heavy weather experience on a boat, we could make that happen, Jack.
Yeah, well, it would be exciting. And I think, is that the trip that you were solo on the boat too?
Yes.
Holy Toledo. So you had your hands full. So what did you do, actually, to get through that?
I reefed the sails.
Besides praying for a little bit.
My boat's a little different design. It's got carbon fiber mast, the first built that way, and it doesn't have shrouds and nothing supporting that. It's a freestanding mast, and so it's very easy to sail. There aren't a lot of lines. There are two masts. There's no jib. So it's really designed for single-handed and going out in the ocean. Which got that boat because we have Point Conception.
Right.
And I don't want to take my family on board during those heavy winds if they happen. So I wanted to be able to do solo. And if we're sailing down to Los Angeles, I can pick them up in Santa Barbara or something.
Right. Nice. But so were you pleased with how the boat performed?
Performed.
In that weather?
Admirably, yes.
Yep. Did you lose anything? Anything fly away?
Two handrails, but that was the extent of the damage.
Well, that's not too bad then. All right. Okay. Well, good.
It's not very much fun, though. I will admit to that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if I never see another storm at sea, it won't be too soon.
Of course, we have to go through those to get the stories.
That is true.
Now it's a good story.
Plenty of stories here on GCAPM Radio.
That's right. So anything else with regard to this lifeboat drop, John, that you want to hit on before we close for the week? Yeah, time flies when you're having fun. We're actually out of time.
It's impressive technology, and we really have to, NorSafe really pushes those limits, but does it in a safe way. And this is exciting. How far will the furthest drop be in 10 years? It may be significantly higher. We'll see.
Yep. And I want to see the inside of one of those boats. I'll have to go check out that movie when it comes out. What is that movie, by the way?
Captain Phillips, of the story of the Maersk Alabama.
So what's the name of it? Going to be Captain Phillips?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
With Tom Hanks.
Good. So we'll have some
playing Captain Phillips, who was American merchant marine captain.
Good. We'll have a good maritime movie to look forward to here in the fall. All right. Anything else before we close, John? Anything in general to tell our listeners?
I got an email from Google's Oceans team thanking us for last week's episode.
Oh,
so
nice.
They are listeners. And
hey, love it.
Did a very nice job to Jeff and the team, and we will keep you updated with future developments.
Well, very nice. We normally don't give shout-outs here on the show, but we'll give the good people over at Google a shout-out. Thank you for that note. We appreciate it, and we're glad to have you as listeners. All right. Well, and to the rest of our listeners, thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week to keep up with what's going on in the maritime and offshore industry. On behalf of John Conrad, myself, Jeff Eccles, and of course all the people here at GCaptain, we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Be well and be safe.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. GCaptain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.